pressure easing in their wake. The woman in the abaya was helped to an ambulance. Police blocked the attempts of reporters to intercept her. The shrewd reporter who'd spoken to Thibault earlier hurried back up the steps.
"Who is she?"
he asked Max breathlessly. Thibault and Elisa were still looking at each other, their faces distorted mirrors of each other, reflections of hope and despair.
"Fuck off,"
was Thibault's response. Khattak reached Elisa first. He wrested the megaphone from her hand and pushed her behind him, watching Thibault's approach with narrowed eyes. Thibault's eyes moved from Elisa to Khattak and back. He scowled, but Elisa ducked under Khattak's arm, refusing his protection. She reached out and took hold of Thibault's hand.
"Thank you," she said simply. "I know that wasn't easy. Not in front of them."
Thibault's breath drew in harshly. He looked down at Elisa's hand as if he couldn't believe she had touched him. For a moment, he did nothing, said nothing. Then tentatively, his fingers fastened around her wrist. He held it as if his lightest touch would break it. He looked up at Elisa, his eyes burning.
"I did it for you."
He looked back over a desolated ground. Discarded placards, broken bottles, bits of debris wielded like weapons. At Lemaire watching him grimly from the bottom of the stairs. He let go of her hand, his face unreadable and cold. He must have remembered the men who were watching him, the ones who looked to him as their leader.
"It doesn't change anything. I'm not some knight in shining armor."
Elisa moved closer to Thibault and took his face between her hands. He stood there, shocked into silence, letting her hold him in place. She looked at him searchingly. He couldn't meet the clarity of her gaze, his eyelashes shielding his eyes.
"Just because you're not with me doesn't mean you can't be someone I respect. You were once my friend, Max. You don't have to do this. You don't have to be this."
She indicated the scene behind him.
"Without you, they're nothing. It will dissipate and end. You could be the one to change things, the one who makes everything better."
Her low voice thrummed with passion, trying to infuse him with belief. Khattak was unbearably moved. He knew he'd underestimated Elisa, the compassion she was capable of. He made a sound of encouragement. Thibault's eyes flicked to Khattak. His intrusion had broken the spell between Max and Elisa. Max took a step back, freeing himself from Elisa. He donned his former attitude like a shield, answering her with scorn. He jerked his chin at Khattak as if accusing her of something.
"You're a whore," he told her. "So you'll forgive me for thinking. Why can't it be me?"
Elisa shuddered. She'd been holding herself so tightly in Max's presence. Then it felt like all the life was leaking from her body. She wanted to crumple up, far away from his hateful words. She thought she'd seen his humanity in his eyes, the warmth she'd known from him in the early days, when she'd thought of him as a friend. He'd shut the protest down because of what he'd once felt for her, but it didn't change the person he'd become. She'd been naive to think that it would. Love, compassion, kindness. There were some kinds of evil that wouldn't bow to their power. She hated herself for having to learn that lesson again.
"That was brave of you,"
Issa said close to her ear. It wasn't. People thought of her as a rebel, as someone who couldn't be hurt, when half the time it was only a front she put up against her fear. It was Mirage who had been the brave one, and it was her memory of Mirage that refused to allow Elisa to give up the fight. But Mirage's restless courage had put her in a grave. Now, this man Eliza had welcomed into the circle of her friendship when she'd first known him had called her a whore to her face. She had to act like it didn't matter because she had been shouldering the burden of shielding the men in her life, Amadou, Yusuf, even Issa. The desperate need of others to protect her, to claim her, to own her in some small way, was fired any time she gave in to her emotions. And she didn't want to be protected. No one could protect them from what had just happened, any more than they could prevent what was still to come. A course had been set in motion, and it was ugly and dangerous, and there was no turning back. There was only getting on with things, choosing the battles she could fight on her own. She made herself seem calm, watching as Lemaire led Maxime over to one of the vans.
I wish I knew why Inspector Lemaire didn't shut the protest down. Why does he keep letting things spiral out of control?
She studied the few remaining protesters. A reporter tried to approach her, but Issa turned him aside. She wished Diana were here. She wished she had a woman to talk to, someone who would help her make sense of her conflicting emotions. She and Rachel had been close once, but now she wasn't sure if Rachel would understand. Rejane waved to her again from across the road. Eliza frowned. She didn't see Amadou anywhere. Had he been caught up in a scuffle? Or did the police have him? Issa hadn't answered her, and she turned to find him watching the play of emotions on her face. She didn't want to blush, but she couldn't help it. Her voice a little brusque, she said,
Did you keep track of Amadou?
He was still watching her, and with a flutter of embarrassment, she realized that he was assessing her actions as a police officer searching for telltale clues. She was saved from whatever he might have said by someone calling her name, Amadou, hailing her from across the road. He'd joined Rejane and Chloe and Emilie, and she could see that he needed her as a buffer against the others. Speaking to Issa over her shoulder, she said,
Rejane wants to talk to you. Let me see what she wants.
He didn't stop her. When she looked back, he was heading to the ambulance, and she knew his first concern was the woman who'd been attacked. She should have been Eliza's first concern also, but Eliza had a fine-tuned sense that events were moving too rapidly for her to wait. They were escalating, and her attempt to reach Maxime might have consequences she hadn't foreseen, consequences uglier than what they'd faced so far. Something told her that whatever the motive behind the shooting at the mosque was, there was a small group of actors at the heart of it. Maxime, Amadou, Yusuf, the Lilies of Anjou, and herself. Chapter 51. When the church had emptied and the remaining officers had dispersed, Khattak had a quick conversation with Lemaire and Rachel. The young men who had been taken into custody had been quickly processed and released. Khattak questioned the wisdom of this, but Lemaire put it down to optics.
There's no way in hell I can hold the Muslim kids, and if I don't hold them, I can't hold the allegiance, not with the circus in town.
He gestured at the reporters. Khattak made his voice sharp.
Are those Isabel's instructions? Shouldn't she be dealing with this?
She has her hands full with the premier, but you can talk to her yourself if you like.
I will.
He left Lemaire to his work. He'd had a few words with those members of the congregation who remained with Père Étienne. From the agonized expression on Père Étienne's face, he could see the priest had taken his words to heart. Words trembled on his lips that he couldn't bring himself to speak. And then Issa's attention was claimed by two members of the mosque who asked him to visit one of their homes and speak to their community privately. He sorted the details out and walked back outside to find Rachel. She had been joined by Seher, and his thoughts brightened at the sight of her. He reached out and took her hand, wondering if she would object to this public demonstration of his interest. Inwardly, he shook his head at himself. The word interest was too civilized to convey the depth of his emotion. Taking her hand was like claiming her, as he'd wanted to do for so long. If she pushed him away now, he didn't know what he would do. She linked her hands with his instead, peering at his face with worried eyes. For his ears alone, she whispered, "I don't think this is what the doctor meant when she told you to rest." His smile at her was warm, intimate, as he bent his head to hers. "As long as you don't tell Rooksh." Seher didn't smile back. "I mean it, Issa. I'm worried." Instantly contrite, he tugged her closer. "I'm sorry. I did try to prevent this. In the end, I couldn't." The rest slipped out before he could think better of saying it. Thank God Aliza was able to calm things down. Seher didn't say anything, but there was a curious twist to her lips. A few steps away, Rachel cleared her throat. She had shaded her eyes with her hand, and she was looking up at the sky with a frown. "This is bloody July," she muttered. "Why are there no days without rain?" She hesitated at the sight of Khattak and Seher with their hands entwined and the aura of two people exclusive to each other. She was happy to see that things were back on track. Khattak seemed to read Rachel's mood. He said something to Seher. She frowned and drew her hand free of his, urging him to go ahead without her.
"I'd like to speak to Rachel for a moment, though."
Khattak nodded, striding across the road to join Aliza and Amadou's group. Rachel braced herself. Growing up in Don Getty's house meant she'd spent her life learning to anticipate when emotional disturbance might erupt. Seher was nothing like Rachel's father, yet Rachel could see she was brimming with unresolved tension.
"What is it?" she asked.
She was surprised when Seher took her aside, under the shelter of a beech tree, drawing her arm through Rachel's. This companionable gesture was so stunning to Rachel that for a moment she lost track of her thoughts. Seher sounded embarrassed as she asked,
"What can you tell me about Aliza?"
They both looked over at Khattak. Rachel wondered if he knew the warmth he sometimes conveyed to both Amadou and Aliza. She did her best to explain it.
"We stay connected to the families we meet through our cases. That's part of our remit. But sometimes the families depend on us a little more than they should."
She shook her head. "I can't say I blame them. We're often their only source of comfort." The sky was darkening around them, and as she listened to Rachel, Seher hugged her arms to her body. There was no chill in the air, just the kind of electrical pulse that gave a forewarning of lightning. She was watching Issa's dark head bent close to Aliza and Amadou, his attention fully focused on the girl. Seher's clear and direct gaze met Rachel's.
"So you're saying what he gives her is comfort?"
Choosing her words with care, Rachel answered,
"I'd call it security. I think he makes her feel safe."
Seher nodded, as if she was considering this. Whatever Aliza was saying to Khattak, it looked like it had developed into an argument. Her face was tense and angry, her eyes flashed, and her hands were balled into fists.
"And is security all she wants?"
Rachel hesitated. Seher trusted her. She wanted to be worthy of that trust.
"I don't know," she admitted at last. "What I do know is that Issa hasn't thought of anyone but you."
Chapter 52. Rachel went over the case with Seher. She needed a favor, and she knew Seher's skills as a prosecutor were too valuable for her to sit around cooling her heels while Khattak wrapped up his work. She didn't want Seher to leave. So she told her about the parts of the investigation where they had come up short and asked Seher to do a little digging. "I've already asked Gaff to make room for you. Just try to stay under the radar in case Lemaire objects. You might also want to check in with the profiler, Dr. Sandston, and get her to tell us what we're looking for. We're missing something here." She described her conversation with Marlies Sandston, but left out the bit about the photographs. That was for Hattak to share. She'd kept the photographs on her person. She hadn't had a chance to show them to Hattak, though she'd summarized her findings for him. Now she made her way over to the Lilies of Anjou. Aliza and Amadou had split apart from the others and were speaking to each other in low voices. Rachel had an uneasy feeling that they were talking about their radio show. She made a note to keep tabs on Aliza, who had always been unpredictable when it came to taking risks. Rejan was in deep discussion with Hattak, something cool and sardonic in her face as she looked Hattak over from head to toe. Rachel wondered what she was thinking, but she was distracted by Chloe tugging softly at her sleeve. Her heart smote her at the sight of Chloe's drowning eyes, her nose and cheeks tinged red, a ball of tissues wadded in her hand.
Do you know anything about the funeral?
In the press of events, Rachel had forgotten her promise about Yusuf Soufian. She apologized, promising to catch Chloe up as soon as she could. She took in the group dynamics with interest. Rejan confiding in Hattak, Aliza and Amadou in conference, Emilie Pelado shifting her attention between Chloe's conversation and Aliza's. As soon as Emilie's back was turned, Rachel drew Chloe aside.
"There was something you wanted to tell me before, in the ambulance. Can you tell me what it was now?"
She lowered her voice.
"You said Yusuf wasn't always good."
They still hadn't publicly released the information about the markings on Yusuf's back. She stole another glance at Chloe's tattoo. The drawings were disturbingly alike. Chloe cast an uncertain glance at Emilie, but Emilie was now wholly preoccupied by the sight of Amadou's proximity to Aliza.
"What I said to you earlier? Well, I didn't tell you the whole truth."
The rest of her face flushed as red as the tip of her nose.
"Yusuf and I wanted to be together, but he said he didn't want to disrespect me. He had to get his family's approval, and his family hated me. That's why we were stuck, because he refused to go against his mother, but he also didn't want to let me go."
She looked so young and helpless as she made the confession that Rachel couldn't believe she'd had the strength and conviction to face down a large, disapproving family.
"What was his mother's actual objection?"
Chloe made a self-deprecating gesture, dismissing herself with one hand.
"Well?"
Her childlike voice faltered.
"There's the obvious. I'm not like Aliza or any of the other girls at the mosque. I have this tattoo."
Her hands began to tear at the ball of tissue, scattering tiny fragments like snowflakes over a grave.
"I wish I didn't, but it's too late to change it now. His mother said it was disgusting. She said I defiled myself. But the main reason is because I'm not Moroccan or Muslim. I come from a Catholic background, so I'm not what she wants for her son."
A little viciously, she added,
"I bet his mother is wishing she'd let him be happy now."
But as soon as she said it, Chloe's face crumpled.
"That was an awful thing to say. She's right, I am a terrible person."
No, Rachel thought. Chloe was a young girl who'd lost someone she loved in brutal circumstances. She could be forgiven for wanting someone to blame. Someone who'd made it clear that Chloe didn't measure up.
"I know she doesn't want me at the funeral, but she doesn't have the right to stop me."
Now Chloe sounded tremulous and brave. Why not?
Chloe's fist rubbed against her heart as though the loss of Yusuf was a physical ache. The tattoo flexed on her wrist.
Because she's not even his real mother.
There was a park bench a few meters away. Despite the pressing threat of rain or the possibility of being interrupted by Emily, who was keeping an eye on them, Rachel pulled Chloe over to the bench and signaled Khatak. She brought him up to speed, her heart thudding, and let him take over the questioning. Whether Chloe's information was relevant or not, it was a lead they had to explore, even if Chloe's frankness created problems for her with her friends.
Can you tell us what you mean, Chloe? Who is Mrs. Soufiane if she's not Yusuf Soufiane's mother?
Bowled over by Khatak's attention, Chloe stuttered her answer.
Stepmother? She's his stepmother? Yusuf's father divorced his mother and later married again. I think Mrs. Soufiane hated me because Yusuf's mother gave me her blessing. But when Yusuf told his family that's when things got ugly.
Where is Yusuf's mother? Does she live here in Saint Isidore?
Chloe's eyes filmed over. Teardrops spattered her cheeks just as the rain came down. She shivered violently, and Khatak suggested they retreat to the church. But Rachel had been watching Emily's approach. She forged ahead, despite the rain.
Tell us, Chloe, it could be important.
Chloe drew a shaky breath, trying to compose herself.
She does. I mean, she did.
Did she move recently?
Chloe's mouth gaped open like a helpless, floundering child. She stared at them wide-eyed, oblivious to the rain.
Shouldn't you already know?
Her breath was the merest whisper.
Yusuf's mother was murdered in the basement of the mosque.
Chapter 53. Why didn't you tell us about Yusuf Soufiane's mother?
There was a note of accusation in Rachel's voice. She didn't care if Lemaire didn't like it. He should have listened to Aliza from the beginning. Their phone lines were jammed with messages of hate, siphoning off resources they could ill afford to spare. He should have rooted the hate out at its source. Instead, it had flourished to the point where it had emboldened mass murder. His negligence had slowed them down. Otherwise, they might have uncovered the necessary connections sooner.
Benoit can pull the victim IDs for you. You can go through them yourself. But what difference does it make? It stands to reason that there were families at the mosque. If Soufiane and his mother were there together, I wouldn't call that a red flag.
Sounding aggrieved, he continued.
A father and son were killed together in the main prayer hall. How is that any different? The line you're pursuing, this family discord about Chloe Villeneuve? Wouldn't it make more sense if, God forbid, Chloe had been the target?
Rachel was forced to back down. Lemaire had drawn conclusions that were so obvious that she should have thought of them first. She was itching to correct him, but she didn't have any ammunition. In a surly tone, she said,
It just seems odd to me, like it's something we should pay attention to.
Lemaire gave a heavy sigh in response. She knew he didn't have time to debate with her. He'd been hung out to dry by the press for doing too little or for doing all the wrong things. The politicians were marginally happier because now they had someone else to blame. Distracted by the sight of Khatak cornering Isabelle Clément, he gave Rachel what she wanted.
Focus on the lilies. That may be the connection you're looking for. Why did someone mark Soufiane with the Lilies of Anjou tattoo?
Rachel snorted, mouthing the words, hate crime, at him. She knew he couldn't disagree when his phone lines were jammed with supporters of the Wolf Allegiance. She watched him rub a hand through his unruly hair. But when he spoke, she could see. He wasn't entirely convinced.
You shouldn't rule out the possibility that the shooter came from within the Muslim community. You and your boss need to prepare yourselves for what that might mean.
for the impact that would have. Rachel stood her ground.
It makes no sense that the shooter would be a member of the mosque. You're missing the pattern, sir. You're missing the question you should be asking.
Which is?
What if these young men who consider themselves pure laine murdered 20 people in the name of the Fleur de Lis? What will that mean for Quebec?
The corners of his eyes pinched tight, because he didn't want to face the answer. Chapter 54. In Lemaire's office, Isabelle Clément showed Issa a series of headlines. The prayer inside the church had already gained traction as an item of national news, fanned by the hyperbole that had bloomed from a single image. The reporter who'd been at the church with Thibault had sold his photograph to all the major outlets. He'd captured the confrontation between Max and Aliza at the church. In it, Aliza was holding Max's face in her hands. They were linked by a visceral emotion. Beauty and the Beast screamed one headline. Beauty Fells the Beast was a slightly more creative take. The one he found most disturbing stated, "Neo-Nazi kneels for love." Thibault would be shamed by it in front of the other members of the Wolf Allegiance. He'd have to take some form of action to save face. His weakness made Aliza a target. He wondered if the French language press had attempted more circumspection. Isabelle spared him a weary glance.
The respectable outlets have been careful. The rest are like a toss-up between Breitbart and InfoWars. The story for them is the desecration of the church by the Muslim prayer.
She must have felt the weight of Khattak's silence because she clarified.
Their choice of words, not mine.
She tapped the monitor with a manicured fingernail, pointing to Aliza's face.
They've found something to hinge their coverage on. Beautiful girls are news, regardless of what they stand for. You'd better warn her about this.
He'd tried, and that was before he'd seen the coverage. But Aliza was as stubborn about her participation in this investigation as she'd been in Waverly. He'd told her she needed to fade into the background, to stay away from public gatherings. She'd coolly informed him that she'd promised to attend a vigil organized by the Lilies of Anjou, and that she'd be reporting on the vigil on her program the following morning. The Lilies' vigil would be held at midnight in the woods, at a prearranged location known only to the young women. Outside of the Lilies, only Aliza and Amadou had been asked to attend. A detail she'd given him as a reassurance. When he'd asked her why she kept up her friendship with the Lilies, given their links to Thibault, her response was considered. Like Aliza, the Lilies had been drawn in before they'd known any better. She refused to cast them aside on that basis, particularly given the sincerity of their feelings for Youssef and Amadou. When he'd told her angrily that she wasn't making his job easier, she'd studied him and said in a careful voice,
"I'm a journalist, Issa. It's not my job to give you cover."
He'd felt the weight of her censure as plainly as if she'd screamed it, but she'd only looked at him quietly, something dark and nameless in her eyes. That she'd refused his advice was nothing new. He'd never been able to bend her to his will. Aliza's commitment to her own course was something he admired, yet despaired of in equal measure. Realizing that Isabelle Clément was waiting for him to speak, he used Aliza's turn of phrase.
"You'll need to provide some cover for our work. There are too many elements we're unable to control. The Wolf Allegiance, Pascal Richard, Aliza and Amadou's radio program."
He sensed the curiosity behind Isabelle's scrutiny.
"Surely a call to the dean of Université Marchand is all it would take to shut down a student-run program?"
She gave a light shrug of her shoulders.
"I wouldn't think that many people listen to it anyway."
Khattak felt the same frustration that Lemaire had expressed earlier. We can't shut down a program that responds to the concerns of the Muslim community while allowing Richard free rein to go on stoking conspiracies. He rubbed his hand along his beard. We need to stop whoever is leaking inside information to the press and to Richard specifically. He crossed to the other side of the desk and sank into a chair. Isabel had personalized her office. Beside her monitor was a framed photograph of a group of young people he thought might be her nephews and nieces. She kept her desk and office as neat and orderly as she kept her person, damping down her good looks with a minimum of makeup, her hair pulled back in a knot. Her charcoal blouse served to emphasize her pallor. When she caught him studying her, he quickly looked away. They sat for a few moments in companionable silence, each preoccupied by the next task, the next thing to be done to tighten the sphere of the investigation so that it wasn't derailed by the national reaction to the tragedy at the mosque or by those who were playing politics. He decided on his next move, then asked her, "Isn't there any way you can convince the premier to shut these protests down?" She sighed deeply, folding her hands on the desk. The nails were painted an unobtrusive rose. The tiny lines of worry at the corner of her eyes reflected the same set of tensions that had been weighing on Khattak. She answered him with a question of her own. "Do you think you could convince the Muslim community to hold off on public prayer? Could you stop Aliza Siddiqui from airing her program tomorrow?" Her questions were not accusations. They reflected the weariness of someone who had to serve as the public face of tragedy without having the authority to determine a more compassionate response. Answering his thoughts, she said, "I can make suggestions, of course, as events unfold, but though I may have the premier's ear, so do many others." Her gaze flicked over Issa with a warning. "Others whose words carry more weight than mine." Unburdening herself, she added, "They need a telegenic face for the cameras. They're not all that interested in the rest." It wasn't offered as a complaint, yet Issa recognized the note of resignation. He'd heard it from many of his female colleagues, frustrated by unnecessary obstacles or by the difficulty they'd faced being treated with respect by the men who stood in their way. Where they should have had responsible, fair-minded partners, they'd had to learn total self-reliance. "Do you regret giving up your career as a defense attorney?" It was a question he'd still not had the nerve to put to Seher, knowing he was the cause of Seher's change in career. Her face relaxed at the question, at the sympathy behind it. "It was challenging in a different way, but I certainly had a great deal more freedom." He studied the now infamous photograph on the wall, Isabel and Christian Lemaire in company with the mayor, awarding the key to the city to Richard. "You're thinking it was a mistake," she said. "Probably you think this is where it began." "I'm more curious as to what you think." She gave him a long, level look. "Maybe there is a deeper game than you've been made aware of." Despite his fatigue and the persistent headache caused by his concussion, Issa was suddenly alert. "You're saying it's all deliberate. You've been casting a lure, waiting to see who it attracts." She didn't answer, simply watching him. Whatever calculations she was making, she was too skilled to betray them. She must have been formidable in the courtroom. "A dangerous game," he went on, "as it led to all of this. And now there's no action we can take because our hands are tied." He said it with an edge to his voice, stifled by their lack of progress. He told her quickly about the midnight vigil in the woods and the potential for another confrontation. There was still a killer on the loose, and Amadou and Aliza had only raised their profiles as targets.
If you need officers at the vigil, that is within Inspector Lemaire's purview.
Issa wasn't put off.
It's within mine, so there will be a quiet police presence, and the officers at the vigil will be under my direct command.
Her shoulders tensed at the words.
The vigil is just a small gathering, though I'll wait until it's over before I head back to Montreal.
In a completely human gesture, she rested her head in her hands.
Just in case anything goes wrong, I'd like to help those who are suffering this loss. The Premier will have to wait.
He must have shown his surprise at this admission of concern, because she frowned and sat back in her chair, shutting off her laptop in the process.
You don't think me capable of empathy for what these families have suffered?
It isn't that. I know you have a job to do. I also know it can't be easy to do it. He wondered if he should try to say something more personal. None of us have had a chance to reflect upon this tragedy, have we? The stern lines of her face softened.
Any emotion I choose to express is seized on as a sign of weakness, whereas the Prime Minister is celebrated for his tears.
I'm sorry, Isabel.
Why, you at least have spoken to me with respect.
Her expression lightened.
A little angry sometimes, no? But then I have also been angry at you.
He was astonished when she reached across the desk to briefly clasp his hand.
We didn't make this mess, but we are the ones who will have to clean it up. I'm willing to act on your suggestions.
Khattak didn't think twice. He told her about his private meeting with the families, and he asked her to invite Diana Shahada to speak at the press conference she had scheduled for the morning, as a gesture of goodwill and a means of restoring trust. They discussed the fact that the woman in the abaya who had been injured during the confrontation at the church had scarcely merited a mention next to the drama played out between Aliza and Maxim.
Ah, God, what a world. You have my word that tomorrow's conference will not echo the disaster of the others.
She made a small moo of distaste, unaware that it pursed her lips in a smoothly seductive gesture.
We can no longer afford to speak without betraying our humanity.
Issa smiled at her, encouraged.
No, he agreed. Perhaps that's the one thing we can't be faulted for.
When Lemaire popped his head in the door to check on how they were getting along, he was greeted by an atmosphere of collegial respect. Muttering under his breath, he said,
"The only good thing to have come out of this."
He waved at them to continue and disappeared. Khattak ran over a few more points with Isabel before excusing himself. Chapter 55. On his way out the door, the phone in the inside pocket of his jacket rang. It was a new phone Gaffney had given him. He palmed it, checking the incoming message with only half his attention. He was looking for Rachel. Réjeanne Baudouin had invited them both to the vigil, waiting for his reaction with mocking self-assurance. When he'd demurred, citing the pressures of the investigation, a spark of amusement had warmed her eyes.
"I thought you wanted to solve this," she'd said. "You might find something at the vigil that you've been chasing your tail to find."
He'd given his usual stiff warning.
"Mademoiselle Baudouin, if you know something of relevance to this investigation, you have a duty to speak."
She'd smiled more widely, displaying a piercing on her tongue. Brushing off his warning, she'd said something that reminded him of his conversation with Isabel.
"Isn't it time you gentlemen listened to a woman for once?"
And as he had with Père Étienne, he wondered what Réjeanne might know. A shock thrilled through him as he made sense of the message that had just appeared on his phone. "Going to the vigil, Inspector? With all those officers present, you won't see the forest for the trees." He looked back at the door he'd just closed, the place where he'd reviewed his plans for the officers in attendance at the vigil, the first time he'd done so out loud. The door to Lemaire's office, occupied by Isabelle Clément, the two most senior individuals associated with INSET, which meant it was more than a leak. To have overheard that conversation in Christian Lemaire's office as it had occurred meant that someone had set up surveillance on Lemaire. He called Gaffney over, and Constable Benoit trailed behind him like an eager and hopeful puppy. Gaffney sent Benoit out to gather the equipment that would allow him to carry out a sweep, privately, once Isabelle had left. When they were alone, he told Khattak,
"You might as well hang on to the phone. It won't make any difference how many times you switch it out as long as you hold on to the same number, unless you'd rather change it."
Issa shook his head. There was a value to receiving the texts. No matter how careful the sender of the messages was, each new message betrayed their familiarity with some aspect of the operation. In time, they were bound to make a mistake. He'd speak to the profiler next. The messages might assist her in creating the profile. He knew she'd been given one of the offices, but they hadn't yet crossed paths. He was working out a plan in his mind. He'd share it with Lemaire alone. They finally had something they could use to flush out whoever was leaking inside information. Gaffney had already conducted 3 spot checks on team computers and cell phones. None had turned up anything incriminating. They weren't dealing with an amateur. Whoever the leak was, he or she was a trained and capable team member who, up until now, had been several steps ahead. Gaff reclaimed his attention with a short summary of his conclusions. "The leak and any possible surveillance may not be connected to the messages you've been sent. Even if they are, it's unlikely they have anything to do with the shooting. Right now, we still don't know what we're dealing with, or who."
"What about the Wolf Allegiance? Has anything broken online?"
Gaff coughed loudly as another officer approached. At the hard look in Gaff's blue eyes, the officer sidestepped and doubled back.
"Plenty," he told Khattak. "All in response to that photograph in the news. They've been piling on Thibault, telling him to step aside. It sounds like an insurrection. He's responded by doubling down with some commentary about the girl. Do you want to see a sample?"
"Give me the gist of it."
"Rape threats, death threats, run-of-the-mill stuff for these guys."
Issa exhaled sharply. He should have assigned Rachel to the sole duty of Aliza's protection. He was impelled by a new sense of urgency, of something transpiring just beyond his grasp, connected to his brief kidnapping and assault? He couldn't be sure, but he could read Gaffney's apprehension.
"That's not why you brought this up."
"Some new stuff, too. Threats of an acid attack, and someone who very specifically promised to finish the work of the shooter."
Benoit approached with an eager smile and a large black bag in his hand. Gaffney waved him off, ignoring his crestfallen response.
"His online name is Broadsword Ben. He says the shooter missed the target the first time around."
"Aliza?"
Khattak asked with a sharp spike of concern. Gaffney nodded.
"Not just Aliza," he warned.
"Then who?"
"If Broadsword Ben is to be believed, the target was Amadou Duchamp."
Khattak's eyes sought out Rachel, who was at another desk with Lemaire. He made a quick decision as she took the call.
"Send a transcript of that chat log to Rachel's phone. If the Wolf Allegiance was behind the attack on the mosque, we need to put this on alert. We need to reach Amadou and Aliza before the Allegiance makes good on its threats."
He read the telltale hesitation in Gaffney's eyes.
"What else?"
The INSET team was on rotation. As new officers crowded into the station, Gaffney ducked into one of the unused offices with Khattak. He brought up the chat log on his phone. Something else you should see. Two things, really. He showed Hatak the photograph that hadn't made the front pages of the main news outlets, but was being bandied about between members of the Allegiance with derisive references to the woman whose face was covered in blood from the attack. It was an utterly callous response to human suffering and pain. Hatak focused his thoughts until his response was coldly analytical. "Track them down," he told Gaffney. "There's enough for an incitement charge here." Gaffney nodded, scrolling farther through the chat.
"There may be more to this than we thought. I've been looking at more than the Allegiance, trying to get the mood of the town from various blogs and online sites. You need to look at threats against Duchamp specifically."
Hatak was impatient. Amadou had told him this himself already. Amadou's rejection of Emilie had stoked the fires of racial hatred, a scenario in which Amadou couldn't win. He would be targeted as much for rejecting Emilie as he would have been for becoming involved. But that wasn't what Gaffney showed him. His hands slick with sweat, Hatak passed the phone back to Gaff.
"They're saying the mosque attack was an operational failure."
Gaffney nodded.
"What background do you have on Amadou Duchamp? Did they target him for reasons beyond the obvious?"
Gaff jerked his head at Rachel, busy at her own desk, scowling as she sorted through a stack of papers.
Rachel's going through it now.
Chapter 56. Wolf Allegiance Chat Room, translated from the French. Subject, Black Dog. Closed group. Broadsword Ben.
Timing was off.
Flay all the players.
Missed the target.
Broadsword Ben.
Target Black Dog.
Death Metal Strike.
Everything else gravy.
Flay all the players.
Missed Max's bitch.
Broadsword Ben.
Still time. Gagnon's lieutenants in play.
Flay all the players.
Shouldn't have double-crossed them.
Maximum damage.
What the fuck you talking about?
Broadsword Ben.
Duchamp dickface crossed Gagnon, scrambled up here to lay low. We let Gagnon know.
Maximum damage.
Gagnon's fucking dead.
Broadsword Ben.
Gang never forgets. Next, they hit your girl.
Maximum damage.
They need to fucking keep away.
Broadsword Ben.
Can't protect Eliza on your knees. You need to get the fuck out.
Maximum damage.
Who has the hit out on Duchamp?
Broadsword Ben.
I'm not telling you shit.
Maximum damage.
Is there a hit on Eliza?
Broadsword Ben.
Fuck off.
Flay all the players.
Fuck off.
Death Metal Strike.
Fuck off and die.
Chapter 57. Rachel was still busy with Lemaire, so Issa switched course, making an effort to find the profiler, Dr. Sandston. One of Lemaire's officers directed him to the office at the back. As he moved through the cubicles and subgroups, he noticed conversations trailing off as he passed. He ignored them, tapping on Dr. Sandston's door. She called to him to come in, but he stopped short when he saw Seher seated at another desk in the room, making notes on a legal pad, her laptop open before her. When she looked up at him, a smile of such sweetness broke over her face that for a moment he couldn't remember why he'd come. He introduced himself to Dr. Sandston before saying to Seher,
"I wasn't expecting to find you here."
She answered his unasked question by showing him what she was working on.
"I'll have something for you on Amadou's background soon. Did you want privacy for your conversation?"
Troubled, Hatak wasn't certain how to answer. Someone senior must have authorized Seher's access. If he pushed her out of the investigation, as he very much wanted to, he might alienate her with what she would view as condescension. If he didn't, their personal relationship might compromise it in some way. He was aware of Dr. Sandston's appraisal of their interaction and wondered what judgments she might be forming. Though he hadn't seen them yet, Rachel had told him about the photographs. Hesitating, he deferred to Dr. Sandston. She invited them both to join her at her desk. She was making a clinical evaluation of his fitness for work, he thought, giving nothing away herself. Rachel had spoken highly of her insights. It reminded him that both he and Rachel had urged that a profiler join the team at the first opportunity, whereas Christian Lemaire had held back, setting back the progress of their time-sensitive investigation, a hindering that almost seemed deliberate. Khattak realized that he was taking Lemaire at his word. If his ranks had been infiltrated by white supremacists, Lemaire was limiting the number of people who had access to inside knowledge. He gave her his own summary of events and asked Sandston to share her conclusions. With that same appraising look, she said, "We're not talking about a single profile here, Inspector Khattak. Please, call me Issa." She didn't make a similar offer in exchange. Perhaps, like Rachel and Isabel, she'd learned the necessity of asserting her credentials. Then again, he had no intention of calling this cool, incisive woman anything other than Dr. Sandston. "There's more than one profile?" "I think there are three." She listed them in those same dispassionate tones. "The attack on the women's area came first. It was conducted execution style at close range with deadly and determined precision. The shooting in the main hall upstairs with a different weapon suggests something else again. Unchecked rage, a commitment to annihilation. The shooting up of the mihrab certainly suggests a personal anti-Islam animus." Issa noted her choice of words. Anti-Islam, not anti-Muslim. Was the distinction significant? "And the third, your kidnapping. The messages you've received, the photographs left for you, the act of causing you physical and emotional duress, that's something else altogether." A number of questions ran through Issa's mind, but Seher spoke up first. "If there were white supremacist markers at the location Issa was lured to, isn't that indicative of the same motivation behind the mosque attack? And then, isn't it likely that the same individual was responsible for each of these scenarios? Issa is quite well known. Is it possible the shooting at the mosque was designed to bring him to a place where he would be more vulnerable?" Though she tried to mask it, Issa heard the tremor in Seher's voice. "It's possible," Dr. Sandston conceded, "but it doesn't align with certain other elements of the shooting." "The broken lights," Issa said. "The lily carved on Yusef Sufyan's back." "Correct. What is your theory, then?" Marlise Sandston reached behind her to collect several sheets of paper from the office printer. She slid these across the desk to Khattak. "Controlled, premeditated rage in the basement, frenzied rage in the main hall, but then the act of marking Yusef Sufyan, controlled again." She showed them a photograph of the carving on her monitor. They both flinched from it, and her cool professionalism eased. "I'm sorry," she said. "I should have warned you. The point is, look at how the lily is carved. There are no hesitation marks, and the pattern itself is perfect, almost artistic." Issa's stomach clenched. "You're saying whoever carved it practiced?" "Yes, they were deeply familiar with the pattern. But also note that Yusef Sufyan was marked like this in the midst of chaos, while the shooter risked being discovered at any moment. Think about the discipline that would require." Seher shook her head, bewildered. "I know shooters like this prepare, but that's not what you're saying, is it?" Dr. Sandston leaned forward, pointing to one of the pages on the desk. She had created a diagram of the shooting, putting events in chronological order and ending with the moment that had been captured on the security footage, the woman in the abaya looking at the camera. What I'm saying is that every moment of this attack was premeditated. The shooter had to consider a number of different things: who he would kill first and by what method, how he would gain entrance, whether he would be able to disguise himself and escape, how best he could avoid a confrontation with police. She paused, thinking over her own words. On the whole, shootings like these are carried out by radicalized white men between the ages of 20 and 40. Shooters who fit that profile are certainly capable of planning. Her fingers traced the route on the diagram. What they are not capable of is total self-possession in the aftermath of the event. The words, "going out in a blaze of glory," come to mind. But this shooter was able to cover his tracks completely, so much so that we don't know where to look. He also managed to implicate the targeted community. Sandston raised her eyes to Khattak's face. "The shooting was personal. It wasn't a random act of violence, which means..." Khattak interrupted. He'd finally understood what she'd been trying to explain. "Which means we have to identify who the target was. Do you think it was Yusuf Sufyan and his mother?" "It may have been." She showed him the position of bodies in the main hall. "But it may have been the imam. It may also have been this father with his small son." "Could it have been Amadou Duchon or Aliza Siddiqui?" He explained about the threats that had been made against them online. A certain alertness entered her expression at his mention of Aliza. He felt Seher straighten in her seat beside him and made an effort to keep his voice neutral. "Of course I can't rule it out, but if Aliza and Amadou were the targets, someone who had planned so meticulously would not have left their absence to chance. So what do the online threats signify, then?" "I would say they're incidental, not to Amadou and Aliza's well-being, to the profile of the shooter." A little of his worry eased. "What about the link we found to biker gangs? There's now a suggestion that Amadou was on their radar, though I don't know why." Seher turned to look at him.
"I may have found something relevant in the files."
"Tell me, Seher."
He knew his voice was different, softer, the tone more intimate when he spoke to Seher, but he couldn't help that. It was why he tried to separate her from his work, a distance she was steadily erasing.
"Inspector Lemaire ran a number of successful operations against the gangs. He himself testified against key members of Gagnon's club, just as Isabelle Clément once represented Gagnon during the course of her work as a defense attorney."
"Does that speak to the profile?" He referred the question to Dr. Sandston, who shook her head. "A personal attack on either Lemaire or Clément would not have been staged at a mosque."
"There was something more on Amadou," Seher said. "It's actually very sad, Issa. I thought he might have told you. Amadou's brother was a casualty of the wars between the gangs. He was killed crossing the street, a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong moment. Amadou hounded Gagnon trying to get justice for his brother. Just before Gagnon's trial, Amadou was badly beaten by one of Gagnon's goons. He escaped to Saint-Isidore-du-Lac."
Khattak went over the chat room transcript in his mind. This new information explained the references to Amadou. If a biker gang thought Amadou Duchon had escaped their delivery of justice, the motive would have been personal indeed, and the window between Amadou's leaving the mosque and re-entering it to speak with Yusuf was nearly negligible. Even the most prepared shooter might have missed the target. The chat log seemed to confirm this. Yet he couldn't simply assume that Amadou had been the target. He needed to consider other possibilities as well. If Amadou wasn't involved, why had the mosque been targeted? Could it have more to do with the politics involved? Isabelle Clément and Christian Lemaire were two high-profile individuals associated with the investigation. could the mosque have been chosen as a target to draw either Isabelle or Lemaire, perhaps both, back to Saint-Isidore to expose them in some manner? Suppose the shooter had known about Lemaire's efforts to root out elements of the far right in the Sûreté? Or suppose they'd thought if the shooting could be blamed on a Muslim woman wearing a veil, it would widen support for the ban on the face veil, ensuring that the premier would not be subject to the pressure to reconsider his position. And Isabelle Clément was the premier's public face. Issa knew there were holes in his logic, but his head had begun to ache, and he couldn't condense his thoughts into appropriate action. It was time for him to reconnect with Rachel to try to find answers. It was how they worked best. "Could you say if the shooter was a man or a woman?" he asked at last. Dr. Sandston spread out her hands, but it was not an admission of failure. "As the shooting was orchestrated, it could easily be either. If we found the missing handgun, that might give us a little more to work with." Yet, despite extensive searches, the handgun had still not been found, which led Issa back to the question of infiltration. If the investigation had been compromised in some way, Dr. Sandston cleared her throat. "I think we should talk about what happened to you now, Inspector Khattak." Khattak's response was sharp. "Because you don't believe the incidents are connected."
"Precisely."
She gave Seher a warm smile. "This is something the inspector and I should discuss on our own." Seher didn't take offense. She shut down her laptop and gathered up her purse. Her hand brushed Issa's wrist, and his whole body warmed at the contact.
"I'll find us some refreshments. I have a sense this isn't done."
Chapter 58. Rachel was still chatting with Lemaire when Sandston called her on her phone, asking her to bring the photographs back to her office. A little awkwardly, Rachel excused herself. A moment later, she was at Sandston's door, Philippe Benoit at her shoulder. Bashfully, he said to Khattak,
"I've got something you should look at here.
Will you give me a moment?" Benoit nodded eagerly.
"I'll just brief Inspector Lemaire."
Rachel hustled him out of the way, closing the door behind her.
"I reckon you have another admirer there, sir. Try not to break his heart."
Khattak grinned, amused, as she'd hoped, by her irreverence. Dr. Sandston pointed to a chair. When Rachel had taken her seat, she was asked to lay out the photographs on the desk.
"All of them?"
A tangible note of alarm raised the register of her voice. Marlies Sandston gave her a chiding glance. She knew why Rachel didn't want to be around while Khattak went over the photographs, but she had to concede when Sandston said,
"How can Inspector Khattak protect himself against things he doesn't know?"
Dr. Sandston arranged the photographs in a pattern. Khattak studied them with a frown. Like Rachel, his attention was fixed on the photo of Seher in Greece. Then his lean and elegant hands touched the photographs taken in Iran and Turkey.
"He's been following me for some time."
Dr. Sandston let the assumption on gender stand.
"Yes."
"To be in Iran and Turkey at the same time as I was would have required detailed knowledge of my movements, advance knowledge, as it's difficult to arrange the visa to Iran."
"Yes,"
Sandston said again. "Yet he had me at his mercy and took no further action."
"He's taken further action."
Sandston's reply confirmed Rachel's own thoughts.
"The text messages, the taunts, he's trying to rattle you, to push you into making a careless mistake."
Rachel's chin jutted out.
"Because he wants Inspector Khattak off the case. He knows it's just a matter of time before we figure out the shooting."
But even as she said it, she knew it was wrong, a fact confirmed for her by Dr. Sandston's swift shake of her head. Rachel pretended not to notice when Khattak slid the pictures from Algonquin toward him. He fell quiet, and neither woman interrupted his perusal of that evening at the lake.
A terrible night.
He didn't elaborate, but then, with a snap of anger in his voice, he added,
For someone else to have been there, yet refused to offer their help. Rachel nearly died that night.
Dr. Sandston stayed silent as he turned to look at Rachel. She made an effort to meet his gaze, her face uncomfortably flushed.
I appreciate that you saved me, sir.
She watched him swallow, unused to seeing him so defenseless.
You saved me, Rachel. I thought you knew that by now.
She let that sink in, a ball of warmth settling somewhere deep in her chest. Her blush deepened as she met Dr. Sandston's probing gaze. She remembered the other woman's words. There are many kinds of love, Rachel. Khattak broke the ensuing silence.
Are these photographs threats? To my family, to Seher and Rachel?
His fingertips lingered on the photograph of himself with Aliza. Marlies Sandston nodded.
Quite clearly, to anyone you care about.
You're concerned about escalation. Frowning, he pulled the photograph of Tom Paley aside from the others.
If this was a case of stalking, escalation would be at the forefront of my mind.
She reached across the desk for the photograph of Paley and held it up to the light.
It's not?
Khattak sounded puzzled.
I'm afraid not.
Rachel knew where this was headed. She bit back a sound of protest. From Khattak's impatience, she could see that he thought Dr. Sandston was deliberately holding back, whereas Rachel knew the doctor was simply gathering herself to tell him.
It can't be a case of escalation if it begins with murder.
Khattak looked at her, shocked. She touched the photograph of Paley.
Sergeant Getty told me that your former colleague Tom Paley died of natural causes, of a heart attack. But we need to consider why Paley's photograph was left for you with the others, and whether the person who took these photos has been acting to harm you from the start.
Chapter 59. Issa found Philippe Benoit in conference with Lemaire.
Join us, Lemaire said, shoving a chair at Issa with his boot.
Anything?
Issa rubbed the back of his head. The ache was growing sharper and more persistent.
Constable Benoit wanted to show me something.
Abashed at being the focus of their interest, Benoit's freckled skin acquired a tinge of pink. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down, but despite his nervousness, he gave a concise summary of his report. He'd been tasked with the long, hard slog of going through Richard's radio broadcasts over a period spanning 2 years. What he'd found was an interview Richard had conducted after Saint-Isidore's code of conduct had passed. Richard had invited a man named Stéphane Marchand onto his show. Khattak didn't know the name. He didn't remember it from his review of key members of the Allegiance.
He wasn't a member of the Wolf Allegiance?
Benoit clarified. Marchand and another man by the name of Jean Roussel were two of Michel Gagnon's chief lieutenants. They were both brought up on a manslaughter charge for the killing of Bilal Duchamp, Amadou Duchamp's brother, but Bilal Duchamp's killing was accidental. He wasn't the target, he was caught in the crossfire. Roussel was convicted of the crime, but Stéphane Marchand had an alibi. Khattak's eyes widened. So they were back to Amadou's brother. Could Amadou have been the reason Marchand had accepted Richard's invitation to come to Saint-Isidore? He followed this up with Lemaire. Why would Richard have hosted Marchand on his radio show? Surely not to speak about the killing of Bilal Duchamp. I'm guessing Marchand would want that safely buried in the past. Benoit placed his large hands on his knees and squeezed.
No, Inspector Khattak, you're quite right.
Marchand was invited onto Richard's show to speak about the code of conduct. His appearance here had nothing to do with Duchamp.
Why would a lieutenant of Gagnon's be invited to Saint-Isidore to speak?
Benoit was red-eared in his eagerness to get his story out.
There was a fundraising campaign aimed at raising the profile of the code of conduct. Stéphane Marchand was the driving force behind that campaign, and as you know, Richard himself was the one who called for the code from the start.
Hattac thought this over. It was clear that Benoit was suggesting Pascal Richard was their man. He glanced at Lemaire, who'd crossed his arms over his chest, his head tipped back and his eyes half closed, mulling his own private thoughts.
Issa couldn't stop himself from saying it.
What price the key to the city now?
To his surprise, Lemaire grinned.
So you're not always as polite. You know how to throw a punch.
He nodded at Benoit.
Continue, please.
The reason the charge against Marchand didn't stick in the Bilal Duchamp case was not only because of his alibi. Marchand is known to move guns and drugs for Gagnon, but there's not a single firearm registered in his own name.
He keeps his hands clean, Hattac noted.
More than that, Lemaire concluded. He's a natural conduit for an unregistered gun,
which meant that Richard could have obtained access to the weapon used in the shooting. Hattac drove himself to his next meeting, overriding Rachel's protests. He'd convinced her not to leave Seher's side until he returned. He was due at the home of Youssef Soufiane's family, where he expected to meet Aliza and Amadou. Once the vigil was over, he'd insist they both be brought under police protection. Until then, he didn't intend to allow either out of his sight, and when he could, he'd find a moment to ask Amadou about the killing of his brother. The Soufiane family owned a home on the upper slope of the town at the north end of the lake. Their back garden was populated with oak trees that feathered down to the lake. An outdoor gathering had been organized. The order of events would be evening prayer, Khattak's address, and then a large communal dinner with the food provided by members of the community. He parked his car and slid his tasbih onto his wrist. Next, he slipped a clean white kufi from his inside pocket and settled it over his hair. His beard was growing in thick and dark, though he'd trimmed it close to his jaw. He'd made the conscious decision not to shave it the moment he'd heard about the shooting. His beard could be taken as a signifier of faith. He hadn't wanted the Muslim community to harbor any doubt. As he was greeted by the Soufiane family and invited to join the prayer in the yard, he felt as though he'd exchanged one identity for another. Here, among this group of Quebecois Muslims, whose origins could be traced to every corner of the globe, his sense of being on guard subsided. The community was ready for him, prepared to receive him as their own, though they spoke many different languages that Issa didn't speak, and his French was only adequate at best. He was invited to lead the prayer. Instead, he chose to give the call to prayer, cupping a hand to his ear. He did this for a reason. It was an assertion of who he was, both publicly and privately. The families would hear him call out the Adhan with the grace of 1,000 past recitations, and they would know who he was. But in shaping the Arabic words into their centuries-old rhythm, Issa would also be speaking to himself. Accepting himself, the mask set aside for now. The Adhan wasn't quite a song, nor was it a chant. Its recitation was something measured in between, an offering of grace to the heart. When he'd finished, he turned to take his place among the rows of the faithful, where several of the women were crying. There was a young woman at the back wearing a royal blue veil. She raised her face to the sky. He recognized Aliza. She wasn't crying. She looked more lost and alone than he'd ever seen her,
something in her posture reminding him of that night in Waverly, the extreme pallor of her shock as she'd come face to face with the knowledge of the violence done to Miraj. Eliza was too young to have seen the dead, yet he knew she had the fortitude to face it. He found himself standing in a prayer row between Youssef Soufiane's father and Amadou Duchon. Their shoulders brushed against each other as they prayed. By the time they'd arrived at the supplication, Soufiane was helplessly sobbing. Issa was moved to comfort him, but Soufiane's wife came to take him away to the house. A young man Issa recognized from the prayer at the church invited Khattak to come forward and speak. His eyes ranged over the small group of men and women of all ages and backgrounds, though the majority were of North African descent. The university student